20. Northfield, Tinian, Mariana Islands, August 6, 1945, 0130 hours. The bringer of death sits in the front seat of a 6x6 Army truck. Approaching the B-29 he personally selected for this mission, Colonel Paul Tibbetts wears a one-piece tan flight suit and a billed cap. In preparation for the coming 12-hour mission, he carries cigars, cigarettes, loose tobacco, and a pipe. Should his plane be shot down, Tibbetts also has a handgun. And if capture becomes a possibility, he also carries 12 cyanide pills, one for each member of his crew. Better to end their lives than be tortured into giving away A-bomb secrets. Tibbetts knew there would be commotion about tonight's mission, but he never expected the sight before him. Floodlights turn the black tropical night into day. Flashbulbs pop as Tibbetts and his crew arrive at the flight line. Scientists and technicians flit around the bomber, fussing over last-minute details. Inside the forward bomb bay, safely concealed from view, is the bulbous 8,900-pound shape of Little Boy, soon to be dropped from a height of 5 miles onto Hiroshima. The target point is the concrete and steel Aioi Bridge, whose T-shape is easily visible from the air. Just hours ago, the B-29 with the number 82 painted on the rear of the fuselage finally got a nickname. Tibbetts wrote the words on a scrap of paper and handed it to a sign painter in mid-afternoon. In the past, he has favored aggressive names such as Butcher Shop and Red Gremlin for his aircraft, but the plane he will fly tonight will hold a special place in history, so he indulges in a rare display of sentiment. By 4 p.m., the aircraft was formally christened Enola Gay in honor of Tibbetts' 54-year-old mother. Years ago, when the colonel angered his father by quitting his job as a physician's assistant at a venereal disease clinic to pursue a flying career, it was Enola Gay who calmed the waters. "If you want to go kill yourself," his father had said angrily, "I don't give a damn." To which the former Enola Gay haggard added quietly, "Paul, if you want to go fly airplanes, you're going to be all right." Now, with the black block letter painting of Enola Gay's name on the silver fuselage, she and her son will forever be linked in history. Footnote: the seldom used name Enola is the word alone spelled in reverse. It is believed that Enola Gay Tibbetts' parents were inspired to give her the name by the 1867 Laura Preston novel In Bonds, in which Enola is the name of a special place to a main character. When Enola Gay Tibbetts later learned that her name was painted on the aircraft that dropped the Hiroshima bomb, her face displayed no visible emotion. However, her stomach would often jiggle when something made her happy. "You should have seen the old gal's belly jiggle on that one," Tibbetts' father told his son of the moment it was announced on the radio. End footnote. There stood the Enola Gay, Tibbetts will later write, bathed in floodlights like the star of a Hollywood movie. Motion picture cameras were set up and still photographers were standing by with their equipment. Any Japanese lurking in the surrounding hills, and there were still some who had escaped capture, had to know that something very special was going on. Soon, the thrum of the 2,200-horsepower B-29 Wright Cyclone engines fills the air as the advanced weather planes Jabot 3, Full House, and Straight Flush lumber down the 8,500-foot east-west runway Able, which has been nicknamed the Hirohito Highway. One by one, the planes take off and ascend into the night for the 12-hour round-trip flight to the Empire. The time is 1:37 a.m. Colonel Paul Tibbetts and Enola Gay are set to take off in 1 hour. Preparation has been intense. At 2 p.m., Little Boy was pulled by tractor to a special loading pit. Due to its size, it cannot fit beneath the B-29's fuselage for loading like normal bombs. Instead, a concrete-lined pit has been dug into the earth. At 2:15, Enola Gay was backed over the pit before the atomic weapon was loaded into the bomb bay with a hydraulic lift. Captain Deke Parsons entered the bay at 3:30 to practice the 11 steps necessary to arm the bomb mid-flight, which he has never done before. Just this morning, Four B-29s rolling out for standard bombing missions crashed on takeoff, detonating all their explosives. Parsons is openly fearful that a similar crash of Enola Gay will wipe Tinian off the map. By 5:30, with the words Enola Gay painted in block letters just beneath the cockpit, the B-29 was ready for pre-flight testing, which went off without incident. At 8 p.m., Colonel Tibbetts conducted a final briefing. In addition to flight routes, altitudes, and departure times, he pinpointed the location of rescue ships and submarines that would be in the area in case a plane had to ditch in the ocean. This information was particularly vital because the U.S. Navy had just issued a warning for all ships to stay at least 50 miles away from Hiroshima. This reduced the potential number of rescue vessels, meaning that only a pinpoint water landing would save Tibbetts and his crew in an emergency. Catholic Mass was prayed at 10 p.m. A Protestant service followed immediately at 10:30. Almost every man attended one or the other. Tibbetts, a man whose only faith is in the physics of aviation, attended neither. The men are loose but pensive, trained professionals who have flown scores of combat missions. However, during the final pre-flight midnight meal of sausage, blueberry pancakes, and real eggs in the mess hall, affectionately nicknamed the Dog Patch Inn, Tibbetts was nervous, though trying not to show it. He ate little, preferring to drink black coffee and smoke his pipe. His time had almost come. 300 miles southwest of Tinian, the USS Oneida, a fast attack transport, has just arrived in the bustling anchorage at Ulithi, an island atoll 400 miles northeast of Palau. She dropped anchor at 1500 hours on August 5th, the same time Little Boy was being loaded into Enola Gay's bomb bay. Oneida is carrying a cargo of fresh Army soldiers traveling from Pearl Harbor to Okinawa, where they will train for the invasion of Japan. The Oneida is a new ship, commissioned just last December. She is 455 feet long and 62 feet wide at the beam, with a top speed of 17.7 knots. In her short time afloat, she has taken a nearly full tour of the Pacific, maintaining almost non-stop motion, carrying men and cargo in and out of combat zones. Since leaving San Francisco on January 30th, Oneida has visited 19 ports or anchorages. Footnote: the Oneida were an Iroquois tribe living in upstate New York who gave their name to counties in New York, Wisconsin, and Idaho, as well as to the ship. The USS Oneida from World War II was actually the third ship bearing that moniker, the first being a brig of war in the War of 1812. The second was a storied sloop of war that served gallantly in the American Civil War from 1862 to 1865 and sank off the coast of Yokohama, Japan in 1870 when she collided with a British steamer. Seven crew members of the ship's second incarnation were awarded the Medal of Honor for their courageous actions. End footnote. A young ensign from Brooklyn, New York, is among the ship's 56-man officer corps. He is 21 and quick-witted, the son of a New York City policeman. In his 9-month stint aboard Oneida, the recent graduate of the Navy's V-12 Navy College training program at the College of the Holy Cross has seen action off the coast of Okinawa, witnessed defeated Japanese soldiers up close when the Oneida ferried 1,050 prisoners of war to Pearl Harbor last month, and experienced all manner of weather, most of all rain, heat, and tropical humidity. In 1 month's time, the ensign will even endure a typhoon aboard Oneida. As with so many soldiers and sailors, the young officer does not know what lies ahead for him. There are, of course, rumors of a massive American invasion of the Japanese mainland. All American military personnel know that would lead to catastrophic casualties on both sides. The ensign will do his duty, whatever happens, but he would like to make it home alive. There is a young woman waiting for him. A methodical man, Colonel Tibbetts makes one last walk around Enola Gay, scrutinizing her for signs of trouble. With 7,000 gallons of fuel and a 4-ton bomb, she is almost 7 tons overweight, so even the slightest malfunction could be deadly. I made sure there were no open pieces of cowling, no pitot covers left hanging, and that the tires were inflated and in good condition. I also checked the pavement for telltale evidence of hydraulic leaks and looked into the bottom of the engine cowlings with a flashlight to be sure there was no excessive oil drip. Tibbetts enters the cockpit through a ladder at the aft end of the nose gear. The other 11 members of the crew also get on the plane, find their seats, and arrange themselves for the long flight. Tibbetts sits in the seat on the left, reserved for the aircraft commander. Co-pilot Bob Lewis takes the right seat. There is tension between the two men, for Enola Gay was Lewis's aircraft before Tibbetts chose to change the name and fly it on this mission. Outside, spectators wait patiently on the tarmac for Enola Gay to take flight. Tibbetts is in no hurry, unworried about his audience or the bruised feelings of Captain Lewis as he runs through yet another pre-flight check of instruments and systems. Once all four engines are running, Tibbetts does a final check of the oil pressure, fuel pressure, and RPM gauges. The thrum of the propellers causes Enola Gay to shake. Only when she takes flight will the vibration cease. The entire checkout and starting procedure required about 35 minutes, and it was now 2:30, Tibbetts will remember. Waving to the crowd of almost 100 who were standing by, I gunned the engines and began our taxi. Destination? Hiroshima. 21. Hiroshima, Japan, August 6, 1945, 7:10 a.m. The humid air is filled with warning. Air raid sirens again awaken the citizens of Hiroshima. The morning has dawned warm and clear with just a few wispy clouds in the sky. A single American B-29 has been seen flying toward the city, causing the alert to sound and disrupting the start of the business day, a time for cooking the morning meal and boarding the streetcar to work. Air raid warnings are now a constant nuisance, but at this late point in the war, it seems unlikely the Americans will finally bomb the city. So while some residents dutifully flee into bomb shelters, others go about their day. In the huge harbor, shrimp fishermen tend to their nets as their ancestors have done for centuries. They ignore the air raid warnings as they have nowhere to flee. In the southern section of town, near the port, the Ujina fire station is relatively calm, and fireman Yosaku Mikami looks at the clock. He is less than 60 minutes away from the end of his 24-hour shift, but any bombing will cause fires, meaning Yosaku's services will be needed immediately. Despite the evacuation of his family yesterday and the empty house that awaits him, Yosaku is eager to get home. He patiently waits for the sound of the all-clear siren, and at 7:32 he hears it. The danger has passed, or so it seems. On the other side of town, 16-year-old Akira Onogi is executing his plan to take the day off from work at the Mitsubishi shipbuilding plant. A studious boy, Akira is angry that he can no longer attend school due to the war, but he now lies content on the floor of his parents' home reading a book. Akira is looking forward to a day of leisure. He has no plans at all. The all-clear siren alerts the people who took shelter at the Hachobori streetcar station that they can now emerge. 20-year-old Akiko Takakura is a cautious young woman, but she now resumes her journey to the Gaibi Bank, where she does secretarial work. The bank, with its stone walls and armored window coverings that let in almost no light, is less than a half mile from the T-shaped Aioi Bridge spanning the Ota River, what will soon be ground zero. 3 days ago, the clock tower at Hiroshima University stopped working at precisely 8:15. The city lacks the spare parts and material to fix it, so the great clock looking down on all of Hiroshima remains frozen in time. As Akiko enters the lobby of her workplace, she notices that the bank clock in the lobby is just a few moments away from striking 8:15. It is an omen Akiko will never forget. Enola Gay flies over Japan at an altitude of 30,700 feet. The overloaded bomber can climb no higher. Weather plane Straight Flush, which caused the air raid sirens to sound in Hiroshima this morning, has reported that the weather is fine for visual bombing. With that message, the fate of the city is sealed. "It's Hiroshima," Colonel Paul Tibbetts barks into Enola Gay's intercom. 6 hours ago, shortly after taking off from Tinian, Captain Deke Parsons and his assistant, Lieutenant Morris Jepson, wriggled through the small pressurized opening separating the bomb bay from the rest of the aircraft. Little Boy almost entirely fills the cavernous space. The ugly bomb is bulbous, with four square tail fins to guide its descent, a design predicated upon performance instead of appearance. A single shackle holds Little Boy in place. Braces keep the bomb from swaying side to side. Standing on a small catwalk, Parsons positions himself at the rear of the device. He needs light to see what he is doing, so Jepson, a physicist educated at Harvard, Yale, and MIT, provides it. The captain works quickly, running through an 11-step checklist that arms Little Boy. Opening a small panel, he inserts four silk packages of cordite powder. This smokeless propellant will detonate the uranium bullet at one end of the bomb's inner cannon barrel. The small chunk of enriched U-235 will race down the barrel and collide with a separate sphere of uranium known as the nucleus at the opposite end. Within 1/1,000,000,000th of a second of the bullet striking the nucleus, a picosecond in technical terms, the splitting of one atom into two smaller atoms will begin the process of nuclear fission. The explosion will follow immediately, releasing deadly heat and radioactive gamma rays. As Parsons arms Little Boy, the sharp, machined edges of the rear panel cut his fingertips. Undaunted, he finishes the job in 25 minutes. His final act is to insert three green dummy plugs between Little Boy's battery and its firing mechanism. Little Boy is armed but fragile. Anything that ignites the cordite charges will cause it to explode, killing all the men on Enola Gay. Thus, the green plugs placed between the electrical connections. As long as those plugs are secure, Little Boy will not detonate. Just before they enter Japanese airspace, Deke Parsons sends Morris Jepson back into the bomb bay one last time. The blonde lieutenant replaces the green plugs with three red arming plugs, thus establishing an electrical circuit between the battery and the bomb. Little Boy is now alive. 1 hour later, Enola Gay bombardier Thomas Farabee announces, pointing straight out the front bubble window of the aircraft, "I've got the bridge." The Aioi Bridge was chosen as Little Boy's aiming point because of its location in the center of Hiroshima and its unique T-shaped appearance visible from the air. Looking down, Colonel Tibbetts can see the white buildings of downtown Hiroshima. He can actually see a mass of movement that looks like people walking to work. "My eyes were fixed on the center of the city, which shimmered in the early morning light," he will later remember. Enola Gay flies the last miles to Hiroshima uncontested. No enemy planes or anti-aircraft fire greet the Americans. Japanese air defense officials, having already sounded three air raid warnings during the night, choose to ignore the B-29's approach, thinking it to be on a simple reconnaissance mission. With 90 seconds to go, bombardier Thomas Farabee positions his left eye over the Norden bombsite's viewfinder. If he does his job properly, allowing for Enola Gay's airspeed of 333 miles per hour and the slight amount of wind that will cause the bomb to drift, Little Boy should fall to the ground with pinpoint accuracy. "1 minute out," Tibbetts announces, breaking radio silence. Farabee flicks a switch that sends a sharp tone into the headphones of the Enola Gay crew and those of the men in the two scientific planes following behind, reminding them of what is to come. They are to put specially darkened goggles over their eyes to protect their vision. All three planes have been ordered to flee the vicinity as soon as possible to avoid the aftershock of the atomic explosion. 30 seconds, says Tibbetts. 20. The bomb bay doors open at precisely 8:15 a.m., the exact moment at which the Hiroshima University clock froze 3 days ago. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. At 8:15:17 a.m., Little Boy is set loose from its shackle. Instantly, Enola Gay lurches upward, finally rid of the four extra tons beneath her nose. Tibbetts wrestles her sharply to the right, almost standing her on a wing as he turns away from Hiroshima. He has less than 50 seconds to distance himself from the blast. If he fails to cover enough ground, Enola Gay will be destroyed by shockwaves. Despite the 60-degree bank, a move more suited to a lithe fighter aircraft than a massive bomber, Bombardier Farabee keeps his left eye affixed to his Norden bombsight, allowing him to watch Little Boy plummet to Earth. The bomb wobbles after first being dropped, but the four stabilizing fins soon force the nose down, propelling it toward the heart of Hiroshima. Farabee is transfixed, knowing that he is witnessing history. 10 seconds pass. 20. 30. Almost too late, he remembers that the explosion's brightness will blind anyone who stares at it. Just in time, Farabee unglues his eye from the bombsite and turns away from Little Boy's descent. 43 seconds after its release at an altitude of 1,890 feet over the Aioi Bridge in downtown Hiroshima, Little Boy's radar proximity fuse detonates. Within the bomb's inner cannon, the four cordite charges explode, sending the uranium bullet hurtling the length of the barrel, where it collides with the second mass of U-235. The chain reaction is instantaneous. In the blast that follows, a fireball spreads out over the target zone. It travels at 100 times the speed of sound, rendering it silent. 1 millionth of a second later, the people of Hiroshima begin to incinerate. Almost 12 miles away, the shockwave slams into the escaping Enola Gay so hard that Tibbetts shouts, "Flak!" thinking the plane has been hit by ground fire. He feels a strange tingling sensation in his mouth, the result of his fillings interacting with the radioactive elements now billowing thousands of feet into the air. But Enola Gay is safe. All 12 men on board are alive. In 6 hours, they will celebrate with whiskey and lemonade and spend the night far from the hell they have just created. Little Boy explodes 300 yards from its primary target. The temperature inside the bomb at the moment of nuclear fission is more than 1,000,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which sends out a white flash of light 10 times the brightness of the sun. Millionths of a second later, the heat on the ground directly below the bomb spikes to 6,000 degrees, bringing with it deadly radioactive gamma rays. A 35-year-old widow, Mrs. Aoyama, has sent her young son off to his mandatory work detail early. Per her daily routine, she is outdoors, working in the vegetable garden she shares with monks from a nearby Buddhist temple. The vegetable garden is located directly beneath the exploding Little Boy, the precise spot on the Earth that will be known as the hypocenter. Mrs. Aoyama is vaporized. Death comes so quickly that her nerve endings do not have time to react to pain, nor even acknowledge the presence of the light and heat liquefying her bones and boiling her brain at a temperature 5 times greater than that of boiling water. Thousands of men, women, and children within a half-mile radius of Mrs. Aoyama are simultaneously reduced to lumps of charcoal, their internal organs evaporating inside their charred corpses. Downtown Hiroshima is instantly covered in smoking black piles that were once human bodies. One woman standing in front of the Hiroshima Central Broadcasting Station tries to flee, only to be carbonized in a running position, her baby pressed tightly to her body. But that is just the beginning. 3 milliseconds later, the sky erupts into a fireball 300 yards wide as the surrounding air ignites, liquefying everyone in its proximity. Then comes the blast as the explosion rockets outward with the force of 20,000 tons of TNT, followed immediately by a billowing mushroom cloud that rises more than 50,000 feet into the air, sucking up dust, dirt and bodily gases from the vaporized remains of those killed at the hypocenter. Within seconds, 70,000 people are dead. Almost every person and building within a 1 mile radius of the hypocenter has vanished. Pets, birds, rats, ants, cockroaches, gone. Homes, fishing boats, telephone poles, the centuries-old Hiroshima castle, all disappeared. Day turns into night as the mushroom cloud blots out the sun. Beyond the 1 mile radius of the hypocenter, some have survived, though at a horrible cost. Flash burns blind all those unfortunate to be caught looking in the direction of the blast, while the intense heat maims and disfigures thousands, many of whom live miles away. One group of Japanese soldiers is burned so badly that their faces literally melt away. It is impossible to distinguish the back of their heads from the front. No one is spared the suffering. A group of students from the Hiroshima Girls Business School are covered with blisters the size of balls on their backs, their faces, their shoulders, and their arms. The blisters were starting to burst open, and their skin hung down like rugs. Japanese photojournalist Yoshito Matsushige will remember. The heat incinerates the clothes of many victims, such as the 15 passengers on a streetcar on the outskirts of the city. They all now lie dead in a naked pile. Because dark colors absorb heat while light colors reflect it, some of the unclothed women have burns in the shape of flowers on their bodies as a result of the designs on the kimonos they were wearing at the time of their death. If the designers of Little Boy imagined a single bomb blast would inflict instant death on thousands, they were correct. The truth is that it does not take much imagination to foresee puncture wounds caused by shards of exploded glass and wood hurtling through the air. The atomic blast wave travels at 2 miles per second, knocking flat anything in its path. Then there is the horror of radiation. Radioactive particles of dust that will slowly kill residents of Hiroshima for months and years to come. But there is even more. Thousands of Japanese die from fire and water. The flames come first, individual blazes that begin at the instant Little Boy explodes. Within 5 minutes, almost every structure within a 2 mile radius of the blast is ablaze, a raging firestorm that propels a powerful flaming wind. Soon that wind reaches hurricane strength, reducing much of Hiroshima to cinders. Many residents are now buried in the rubble of their collapsed homes. Trapped beneath thick wooden beams and tons of ceramic roof tiling, they frantically plea for rescue as the fires burn closer. Their screams echo throughout the streets of Hiroshima. To escape the firestorm or to cool the burns covering their bodies, many Japanese leap into the city's firefighting cisterns. But what happens next is yet another cruel twist of fate. The explosion has superheated the water, and everyone immersing himself or herself in it immediately boils to death. Others try to escape the flames by diving into one of the 7 rivers that flow through Hiroshima, only to find the water clogged with dead bodies. Many are actually pushed into the water by the enormous crowds trying to flee the firestorm. Once they are caught in the current, the number of corpses makes it impossible to swim. I saw a few live people still in the water, knocking against the dead as they floated down the river, one eyewitness will later recall. There must have been hundreds and thousands who fled to the river to escape the fire and then drowned. Hiroshima is chaos. Some confused citizens maintain almost total silence as they endure the horrors of Little Boy. Many wander the streets in a daze, arms held away from their bodies to prevent them rubbing against their burns, staring at the carbon lumps on the street, picking their way through the debris and absorbing the surreal nature of what has happened. Others, their homes destroyed, join the long line of Hiroshima's citizens frantically retreating to the safety of the countryside. Just seconds after Little Boy's detonation, the Japan Broadcasting Corporation in Tokyo notices that their Hiroshima station is off the air. The control operator gets on the phone to see if he can help fix the problem, but gets no response. Soon it becomes clear that Hiroshima's train station, telegraph operators, and military garrison have also severed communications. Fearing an American bombing, the headquarters of the Japanese military, the General Staff Office, dispatches a young officer from Tokyo to investigate. His orders are to fly to Hiroshima immediately and ascertain whether or not the city has been the target of an American attack. The next day, the chilling results of what the young officer saw from the air are reported on Japanese radio. Practically all living things, human and animal, were literally seared to death. Those who survived the bombing of Hiroshima will forever be known in Japan as the Hibakusa, the explosion-affected people. The difference between survival and death is often luck. Standing inside a concrete building that blocks the shockwaves, or having the good fortune of not being pinned beneath a large beam when a house collapses. The atomic bomb does not discriminate, Hiroshima weatherman Isao Kita will remember. The atomic bomb kills everyone from little babies to old people. And it's not an easy death. It's a very cruel and very painful way to die. Among the Hibakusa is fireman Yosaku Mikami, who was spared death on his way home because his streetcar was shielded from the blast by a tunnel. The car passed through Miyukibashi and was approaching the train office when I saw the blue flash from the window. At the same time, smoke filled the car, which prevented me even from seeing the person standing directly in front of me. Yosaku returns to the fire station, where he joins his colleague on the fire truck. They are confronted by utter chaos and unimaginable horror as they come upon scores of victims swearing, screaming, shouting, asking for help. Yosaku and his fellow firefighters immediately go to work, hoping to find a hospital where they might take the worst of the victims. We tried to open the eyes of the injured, and we found out they were still alive. We tried to carry them by their arms and legs and to place them onto the fire truck, but this was difficult because their skin was peeled off as we tried to move them. But they never complained they felt pain, even when their skin was peeling off. Yosaku and the other firemen travel through the city, tending to the wounded and visiting other fire stations to determine the fate of their brother firefighters. They find many still alive, combating the blazes. But they also come upon scenes of horrifying death. At one station, Yosaku finds a fireman scorched to death inside his truck. He looked as if he was about to start the fire engine to fight the fire. Stunned by the shockwaves, 16-year-old Akira Onogi is thrown through the air and knocked unconscious. When Akira comes to, he walks outside to find his neighbor standing naked in the rubble of his ruined home, too consumed with searching for lost family members to care about the flaps of burned flesh hanging off his own body. I talked to him, but he was too exhausted to give me a reply. He was looking for his family desperately, Akira will long remember. We found this small girl crying, and she asked us to help her mother, trapped by a fallen beam on top of the lower half of her body. Akira and a group of onlookers work together to lift the crushing section of wood, but their efforts are in vain. Finally, a fire broke out, endangering us, so we had no choice but to leave her. She was conscious, and we deeply bowed to her with clasped hands to apologize to her, and then we left. For the next 10 years, sparks given off by electric streetcars will startle Akira, reminding him of the A-bomb's instantaneous flash, the Pikadon, or spark and bang, as it is so often called by survivors. And he will never sit by a window, having seen far too many corpses pierced by exploding panes of glass. But the most vivid moment, the one that will stay with Akira the rest of his life, is the memory of the daughter and her doomed mother. 30 years after the atomic bomb blast, Akira will immortalize his sorrow on canvas, painting the scene with unbridled emotion. He places himself in the painting's bottom right-hand corner, hands pressed together in remorse, as the sobbing little girl begs him to save her mother's life. Footnote: Akira's painting will become one of the iconic images of the Hiroshima bombing, frequently to be seen on display at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. End footnote. Gaibi Bank employee Akiko Takakura is also among those spared. She stepped into work just moments before her workplace exploded at 8:15, stopping the bank's clock at that precise time. "When I was doing my morning routine, dusting the desks and things like that, the A-bomb was dropped. All I remember was that I saw something flash suddenly. Though the bank is just 300 yards from the center of the bomb blast, its stone walls and armored window coverings provide perfect protection. Just on the other side of those walls, on the steps leading into the bank, Akiko would have been instantly burned into a carbon lump. Momentarily knocked unconscious from the blast, Akiko wakes up a short time later and staggers out into the street to a scene of profound horror. Many people on the street were killed almost instantly. The fingertips of those dead bodies caught fire, and the fire gradually spread over their entire bodies from their fingers. A light gray liquid dripped down their hands, scorching their fingers. I was so shocked to know that fingers and bodies could be burned and deformed like that. Akiko wanders through the city in a daze, her progress slowed by the countless dead bodies she carefully steps over. She makes her way to the former military garrison, where bare-chested soldiers were performing their morning calisthenics just an hour ago. At the drill ground, the burnt field was strewn with what must have been dead soldiers. She lies down on the ground to rest. I don't know how much time passed, but at dusk, I suddenly vomited what must have been the remnants of my breakfast. I vomited bloody phlegm twice. I knew then that I, too, would die in that place. Despite 102 cuts on her back from flying glass and debris, along with two serious burns and many bruises, Akiko finds the will to go on. I'm going to live. I've got to live, she tells herself. A half century from now, determined that a new generation of Japanese must never forget the horror she is experiencing today, Akiko will write the poem, To Children Who Don't Know the Atomic Bomb, describing that morning in graphic detail and ending with the following unforgettable image. One woman walking on the road died, and then her fingers burned, a blue flame shortening them like candles. Footnote. Eyewitness Testimonies, Appeals from the A-Bomb Survivors, Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. Decades after the blast, at the age of 45, Akiko was diagnosed with a tumor on her spine, which was successfully removed. In 2012, at the age of 86, she was diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS, a blood anomaly that is often a precursor to leukemia. Both of these conditions are common in survivors of the atomic bomb. At the age of 89, Akiko currently carries out the duties of the head priest's wife at the Hunji Temple in the Asakita Ward of Hiroshima. End of footnote. The time in Tokyo is 7:50 p.m. It has been 11 hours and 35 minutes since Little Boy was dropped on Hiroshima. Many in the Japanese high command believe that the bomb was atomic, but the generals have withheld this news from their emperor all afternoon. It is dusk, and Hirohito takes advantage of the warm August night to stroll the gardens of the Imperial Palace, completely unaware of what has happened in Hiroshima. Suddenly, an aide from the Imperial Japanese Army approaches, which can only mean bad news. Such an intrusion on the Emperor's solitude is unheard of except in a time of tragedy. In somber tones, the aide informs Hirohito that Hiroshima has been attacked with a special bomb from a U.S. bomber. The aide goes on to state that the Navy Ministry, which has been investigating the attacks, believes that most parts of the city have ceased to exist. The aide leaves, allowing Emperor Hirohito to ruminate on what he has just heard. Since the fall of Okinawa 6 weeks ago, he has known that Japan cannot win this war. For a reminder of the Americans' dominance, Hirohito need only look around the Imperial Palace. Despite standing orders by the U.S. military that the Emperor's palace should not be bombed, fires started by B-29 raids on Tokyo have leaped the great stone walls and moats surrounding his fortress and burned Hirohito's wooden residence to the ground. Hirohito and his family now live in the Imperial Library, adjacent to the enormous gardens in which the Emperor now walks. All of the Emperor's official business is conducted in a bunker 60 feet underground. In that way, he is similar to his deceased ally, the German leader Adolf Hitler. Like Hitler, Hirohito has refused to surrender. He has persisted in the belief that the Russians will help him negotiate peace with America. The emperor still believes that now. However, he is staggered by the news from Hiroshima. If the reports from the city are true, Hirohito knows that only unconditional surrender will save Japan from complete destruction. This will mean the end of the 2,500-year-old imperial dynasty, and perhaps the end of Hirohito's own life, should he be tried and found guilty of war crimes. But 5 hours later, when American President Harry Truman once again demands unconditional surrender from Japan, Hirohito's response is utter silence. While his devastated people suffer and die, the God-man continues his stroll. 22. USS Augusta, Mid-Atlantic, August 6, 1945, noon. Harry Truman is feeling powerful. Holding court just before lunch in the USS Augusta's enlisted men's mess hall, he banters with the 6 sailors at his table, asking about their hometowns and life in the Navy. Truman could have flown home after his 3-week stay at the Potsdam Conference in Germany, but his security agents recommended making the 5-day transatlantic journey by sea because they feared an attack in the sky. The voyage has been blustery, the wind-blown Atlantic covered in white caps and rolling swells. Yet Truman has risen early each morning for a walk on deck in the open air. The crew has been surprised to see the president wearing a broad smile during these morning constitutionals, despite the ongoing conflict in the Pacific. They cannot possibly know the tremendous feeling of success he feels after holding his own on the world stage at Potsdam, and even more important, they do not know that Truman is awaiting confirmation that an atomic bomb has been dropped on Japan. The president has had a hard time keeping this top-secret news to himself. There are a handful of journalists on board the ship, and on the day Augusta set sail from Plymouth, England, Truman met with them to explain that America possessed the atomic bomb. He shares this staggering news, safe in the knowledge that the media are forbidden from using the ship's radios and have no way of communicating the information. In this particular isolation, the talkative Truman gets to explain the A-bomb on his terms, and yet the weapon maintains its confidential status. As Truman now chats with the young sailors prior to eating lunch, Captain Frank H. Graham approaches the table holding a map of Japan and a teletype message. Hiroshima is circled in red pencil on the map. The message reads, "Hiroshima bombed visually. Results clear-cut successful in all respects. Visible effects greater than in any test. Conditions normal in airplane following delivery." Truman's face lights up. "This is the greatest thing in history," he proclaims to Graham, enthusiastically shaking his hand. "It's time for us to get home." The president then orders Graham to share the secret message with Secretary of State James F. Burns, sitting just a few tables away. A second teletype arrives moments later from Secretary of War Henry Stimson, confirming the previous report. "Big bomb dropped on Hiroshima August 5 at 7:15 p.m., Washington time. First reports indicate complete success." Truman can't help himself. Leaping to his feet, he taps his water glass with a fork. At first, there is confusion. These military men immediately rise to attention, realizing the impropriety of the president standing as they sit. But Truman waves them back down. "Please keep your seats and listen for a moment. I have an announcement to make. We have just dropped a new bomb on Japan which has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It has been an overwhelming success." Bedlam sweeps through the mess hall. Cheers echo down the ship's passageways. A grinning Truman holds the teletype message aloft as he races from the mess hall and runs down the corridor to share the news with Augusta's officers. "We won the gamble!" he shouts above the jubilant celebration. Everyone believes that the end of the war has arrived. They are wrong. Within moments, dressed in a tan double-breasted suit and dark tie, President Truman films a message to the American people from his stateroom aboard the Augusta. He sits at a desk, a porthole visible over his right shoulder. The text of his speech was prepared long ago, but only just released to the national media by the White House. But Truman's words, which are also being broadcast live on the radio, have a far more powerful effect than a print dispatch. For while this message may seem to be aimed at the American people, it is in fact a warning to the Japanese leadership. 16 hours ago, an American plane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy, he begins. Truman's tone is somber, but there is no doubt he feels justified in his decision. Even as he speaks, more leaflets are being dropped on Japan, encouraging the people to rise up and demand that their leaders surrender. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. Truman then tells the history of the bomb's development, concluding with an unmistakable reminder that the job is not yet done. Only Japan's acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration and its terms of unconditional surrender will stop the bombings. We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on earth. Finally, Truman signs off. He does not need to order a second bomb to be dropped on Japan, for that command was given 2 weeks ago, on the same date he approved the Hiroshima attack. In fact, the order allows for bombings to continue as long as there is a supply of atomic bombs. The Augusta is just north of Bermuda as Truman completes his speech. The temperature is finally warming. Knowing that a media whirlwind awaits him upon his arrival home tomorrow, the president settles in to enjoy a day of sunshine, hoping for news of a Japanese surrender. In Manila, General Douglas MacArthur is appalled. It is just after midnight on Tuesday when an aide awakens him with news of the Hiroshima bombing. The general is hypersensitive to slights both perceived and real, and when it comes to the atomic bomb, there have been many. For the past 3 years, MacArthur has waged war on his terms, attacking when and where he wants. He knows the Japanese culture from his decades living in the Pacific and is confident that they are on the verge of surrender. Even though MacArthur wears the 5-star rank of General of the Army, President Truman has rarely consulted him about the state of the Pacific conflict, unlike George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower, who routinely advise the president on matters of war. While Marshall has long known about the bomb and Eisenhower was made aware of it shortly after the Trinity explosion, MacArthur learned of its existence only 1 week ago. MacArthur was never once asked about the A-bomb's tactical use in his theater of war. It is a situation, he believes, no different than if the A-bomb had been dropped on Europe without Eisenhower being informed. MacArthur knows that would never happen. Now, on top of those insults, comes the stunning realization that Harry Truman does not trust Douglas MacArthur. On Sunday, August 5th, the general received verbal confirmation that the bomb would be dropped the following day. However, this courtesy also contained a key element of misdirection. Instead of Hiroshima, the courier from Washington informed the general that Ground Zero would be a lightly populated industrial district south of Tokyo. Someone somewhere believes Douglas MacArthur cannot keep a secret. Unfortunately, MacArthur's behavior lends credence to the view that he can't keep his mouth shut. On the morning of the Hiroshima explosion, still not knowing its true location or whether the mission has been a success, MacArthur calls reporters to his office at Manila City Hall and, in off-the-record comments, coyly predicts, "The war may end sooner than we think." The truth is that MacArthur approved of the Tokyo strike, showcasing the power of the explosion in an area almost completely devoid of civilians made military sense to him. The tragic slaughter of Manila's residents by the retreating Japanese just a few months ago is still fresh in MacArthur's memory. Even before those senseless killings, the general has been openly opposed to targeting civilians. When Japanese commanders accused his troops of firing artillery at a hospital in Rabaul on the island of New Britain, MacArthur immediately denied the charge and used a neutral embassy in Tokyo to send a message to the Japanese general telling him that an artillery battery next to the hospital was the real target. But there is inconsistency in his stance. MacArthur does support the bombing of civilians when it suits his purposes, such as the aerial attacks designed to soften up the island of Kyushu for Operation Olympic. At this point in his career, MacArthur's military training precludes him from publicly criticizing his commander-in-chief, but for the rest of his life, he will privately share his views about August 6, 1945. "MacArthur once spoke eloquently to me about it," Richard Nixon will one day recount to reporters. "The future president served a year in the Pacific during World War II as a naval officer. He thought it a tragedy that the bomb was ever exploded. MacArthur, you see, was a soldier. He believed in using force only against military targets, and that is why the nuclear thing turned him off." Others will reveal that MacArthur saw no earthly justification for dropping the bomb. Footnote. Quoted from a post-war interview with journalist Norman Cousins, later published in the book The Pathology of Power. End footnote. MacArthur's personal pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Weldon Dusty Rhodes, will remember MacArthur's opinion of the bomb even more vividly, writing in his journal, "General MacArthur definitely is appalled and depressed by this Frankenstein monster." Accurately, MacArthur believes that bombing Hiroshima will not lead to a Japanese surrender. The shame would be overwhelming. According to MacArthur, a Japanese surrender will happen only if President Truman allows the emperor to remain in power after the war. "The retention of the institution of the emperor will allow the Japanese nation to seek peace with dignity, knowing that their divine emperor will continue to guide them." But most Americans see the situation far differently. "Thank God for the atomic bomb" is a common refrain among American soldiers and sailors who have been dreading the bloodbath sure to come if American troops invade the beaches of Japan. To many of them, the bombing of civilians is not an issue. It's payback for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And if the destruction could lead to peace, U.S. enlisted men almost unanimously believe it is worth it. For the first time since they put on that uniform, these soldiers and sailors can start planning for the distant future. "For all the fake manliness of our facades," a 21-year-old infantry lieutenant will write, "we cried with relief and joy. We were going to live. We were going to grow up to adulthood." In Los Alamos, New Mexico, Robert Oppenheimer stands before an auditorium filled with the scientists who designed and produced the atomic bomb. Clasping his hands over his head like a boxer entering the ring, he tells the cheering audience that it is too early to determine what the results of the bombing might have been, but I'm pretty sure the Japanese didn't like it. Oppenheimer soon leaves the stage, but not before bringing down the house with his final comment. "My only regret is that we didn't develop the bomb in time to use it against the Germans." A Gallup poll reports that 85% of Americans believe that the use of the atomic bomb is justified. Most of the media also support the decision. Across the country, newspapers trumpet the A-bomb blast in banner headlines. The New York Times reports the event with 6 front-page stories. The Times, however, sounds a rare cautionary note on its editorial page, predicting that the use of the A-bomb will now be justified by other nations in the future. "Yesterday, man unleashed the atom to destroy man, and another chapter in human history opened, a chapter in which the weird, the strange, the horrible becomes the trite and the obvious. We clinched victory in the Pacific, but sowed the whirlwind. Americans have become a synonym for destruction. And now we have been the first to introduce a new weapon of unknowable effects which may bring us victory more quickly, but will sow the seeds of hate more widely than ever." Footnote. The editorial was written by journalist Hanson Baldwin, military editor of the New York Times. End footnote. There are others who display trepidation. Manhattan Project physicist Luis Alvarez, after observing the explosion aboard the Great Artiste, begins questioning the bomb's morality. In a letter to his son written on the return flight to Tinian, he ponders what he has just seen. What regrets I have about being a party to killing and maiming thousands of Japanese civilians this morning are tempered with the hope that this terrible weapon we have created may bring the countries of the world together and prevent future wars. David Lawrence, the conservative founder of the United States News, will pen one of the most damning criticisms of Truman's decision. We shall not soon purge ourselves of the feeling of guilt which prevails among us. Military necessity will be our constant cry in answer to criticism, but it will never erase from our minds the simple truth that we, of all civilized nations, though hesitating to use poison gas, did not hesitate to employ the most destructive weapon of all times indiscriminately against men, women, and children. What a precedent for the future we have furnished to other nations, even less concerned than we with scruples or ideals. Footnote. The United States News would later become the U.S. News and World Report. End footnote. In Japan, there is simply shock, but no talk of accepting the Potsdam Declaration and surrendering. Instead, as a wave of 385 B-29 bombers attacks four targets in Tokyo with conventional bombs, the military broadcasts a series of defiant radio messages from the capital. The people of Japan are directed to remain calm in the face of American bombings and to renew their pledge to continue the fight. An August 8th broadcast in English, aimed at North America, accuses the United States of an atrocity campaign that will create the impression that all Japanese are cruel people. And while Japan has ignored the terms of the Geneva Conventions and Hague Conventions throughout the war, it is the United States that the Japanese now accuse of war crimes. This is made clear by Article 22 of the Hague Convention. Consequently, any attack by such means against open towns and defenseless citizens are unforgivable actions. Footnote. Article 22 of the Hague Convention reads, "The right of belligerents to adopt means of injuring the enemy is not unlimited." End footnote. The broadcast asks, "How will the United States war leaders justify their degradation, not only in the eyes of the other peoples, but also in the eyes of the American people? How will these righteous-thinking American people feel about the way their war leaders are perpetuating this crime against man and God? Will they condone the whole thing on the ground that everything is fair in love and war? Or will they rise in anger and denounce this blot on the honor and tradition and prestige of the American people?" In an unusual attempt to win the sympathy of Europeans, a third broadcast is transmitted in French. "As a consequence of the use of the new bomb against the town of Hiroshima on August 6th, most of the town has been completely destroyed, and there are numerous dead and wounded among the population. The destructive power of these bombs is indescribable, and the cruel sight resulting from the attack is so impressive that one cannot distinguish between men and women killed by the fire. The corpses are too numerous to be counted. The destructive power of this new bomb spreads over a large area. People who were outdoors at the time of the explosion were burned alive by high temperatures, while those who were indoors were crushed by falling buildings." Footnote. It is difficult to get exact statistics regarding Hiroshima casualties. The transient nature of the military population and the number of civilians evacuated to the country in the days leading up to the bombing skew precise population numbers, but it is estimated that Hiroshima's population was 255,000 at the time of the bombing. More than 50,000 people are thought to have died instantly, and another 70,000 were injured. One Japanese study later showed that burns accounted for approximately 60% of all deaths, falling buildings and flying debris made up 30%, and gamma radiation accounted for 10%. By November 1945, 3 months after the blast, the estimated death toll had climbed to 130,000 due to lingering infection from burns and radiation poisoning. 7 decades later, the residual effects of the atomic bomb, such as cataracts and leukemia and several other forms of cancer, still plague the people of Hiroshima. Statistics at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum put the death toll at 200,000. End footnote. The Tokyo broadcasts can be heard quite clearly 1,500 miles away on the island of Tinian, where a B-29 bomber is now loaded with a second atomic weapon, an even more lethal plutonium bomb codenamed Fat Man. American aircrews are gearing up to unleash more hell on what is now a defenseless Japan. In addition, the dictator Joseph Stalin is set to attack Japanese-held territory in Manchuria. The plan for that sneak attack has been kept from Harry Truman and America, as Stalin has rightly assessed Japan's weakness. In just 3 short days, the world has changed, and it will now be altered even further. The next A-bomb destination is about to be revealed. 23. Tokyo, Japan, August 9th, 1945, 10:30 a.m. Emperor Hirohito is morose. He again walks through the elms and pine trees of his extensive garden, knowing the war is lost. He is brooding about the destruction of Hiroshima. He knows it has crushed the spirit of the Japanese people, and now there is even more horrible news. The Soviet Union has invaded Manchuria. Footnote: the Soviet Union's invasion of Manchuria was the last epic battle of the Second World War. While often overlooked, the clash occurred on a scale comparable to the Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944. 1.5 million Russian soldiers faced off against 713,724 Japanese troops. The Soviets routed the Japanese within a matter of weeks, losing an estimated 12,000 men killed and 24,000 men wounded. Japanese casualties were 22,000 killed and another 20,000 wounded, but just as debilitating was a historical rarity: mass desertion in the ranks. As in so many Russian conquests throughout Europe, rape and looting in Manchuria quickly followed. The joy many Chinese felt upon being liberated from their Japanese captors was soon replaced by fear and loathing for the Soviets. End footnote. Although he is protected in a bunker, Hirohito understands that his people are not. The United States has been bombing Japan for months, destroying so many cities that they are running out of targets. Tokyo itself has been hit more than a dozen times. Just last night, the emperor once again heard air raid sirens throughout his capital city as 60 B-29s bombed a nearby aircraft factory. The Japanese people are weary of war, but they continue to endure it, hoping to save their god king from shame. The invasion of Manchuria makes surrender inevitable. Russia and Japan signed a non-aggression pact 4 years ago, which Stalin has now violated. Hirohito knows the Russians to be an aggressive people, as evidenced by their continued occupation of Eastern Europe 3 months after the European War. The Soviet entry into the Pacific War makes it possible that the Russians may also attempt to invade Japan. Hirohito's nation has neither the men nor the arms to hold off a two-pronged American and Soviet invasion. Ignoring the heat, Hirohito continues to ponder the possibility of surrender. But this path is fraught with peril. The Japanese military might not cooperate. Some military and civilian leaders actually welcome the coming invasion for the chance to make a historic last stand against people they consider to be barbarians. If it came to a final battle on Japanese soil, War Minister Korechika Anami believes, we could at least for a time repulse the enemy, and might thereafter somehow find life out of death. Even as the emperor absorbs the terrible news about the Soviet attack in Manchuria, the top military and civilian cabinet known as the Supreme Council for the Direction of the War is meeting in the concrete bunker beneath the residence of Prime Minister Kentaro Suzuki to discuss whether or not to accept the Potsdam Declaration and take the first steps toward surrender. Hirohito knows that surrender to the Americans will require the complete backing of his military. Despite Hirohito's deity and his imperial reign, it is the military that truly holds power in Japan. It has been almost 10 years, but Hirohito well remembers the terrible events of 1936, when a military mutiny saw the assassination of several top government officials and the takeover of downtown Tokyo. A faction loyal to Hirohito was successful in crushing the revolt, but there is no certainty the results will be the same should such a coup happen again. In his Spartan Manila office, General Douglas MacArthur greets the news of the Manchurian invasion with great joy. "I am delighted at the Russian declaration of war against Japan. This will make possible a great pincers movement which cannot fail to end in the destruction of the enemy." In Europe, Russia was on the Eastern Front, the Allies on the West. Now the Allies are on the East and the Russians on the West, but the results will be the same. Like many other top American military leaders, MacArthur still sees Joseph Stalin as an ally, not an enemy. He has previously told other officers that, "We must not invade Japan proper unless the Russian army is previously committed to action in Manchuria," believing that such an invasion would pin down Japanese divisions that might otherwise be shifted to fight against American forces. The general also thinks that Russian occupation of large segments of China and Korea is inevitable, not realizing he will one day be called upon to fight the communist advance in those areas. It has now been 3 days since the atomic bomb was dropped. The Japanese have chosen not to surrender, and MacArthur is still hoping to lead the greatest amphibious invasion in the history of the world. To the general's way of thinking, another A-bomb is not needed. America has him. In Hiroshima, the stench of burned flesh and rotting corpses still hangs over the city as citizens search for missing family members. In scenes played over and over again, the living wander into first aid stations, calling out the names of lost loved ones. They are rarely answered. The surviving soldiers of the Akatsuki Corps lead relief efforts, distributing rice, using wood to burn dead bodies, and arranging transportation out of the shattered city for the living. A light southerly wind blowing across the city wafted to us as an odor suggestive of burning sardines. I wondered what could cause such a smell, until somebody, noticing it too, informed me that sanitation teams were cremating the remains of people who had been killed. The dead were being burned by the hundreds, one survivor will later remember. The mayor of Hiroshima at the time of the blast was a teetotaling Christian named Senkichi Awaya. His official residence was in the city's Kakomachi district, well within the blast zone radius. At the time of the detonation, he was eating breakfast with his son and 3-year-old granddaughter. All three were killed instantly. Awaya's wife, the mother of his 7 children, survived the bombing, only to die 1 month later from radiation poisoning. Footnote. The radioactivity caused by the fission of uranium most severely affected those within 2 miles of the blast center, causing vomiting, diarrhea, hair loss, damage to the bone marrow, which affects the body's ability to produce blood, and large bumps on the skin known as keloids. The lack of white blood cells in victims led to sepsis and infection. Delayed effects included the abnormally high mortality rate among fetuses subjected to high levels of radiation and high levels of mental impairment for those in utero who survived birth. The radiation poisoning was caused not just by the initial blast, but also by the highly radioactive black rain that began falling 20 minutes later. Even those who visited Hiroshima's hypocenter in the weeks after the explosion were subjected to extremely high levels of radiation and began displaying symptoms. Most victims, 90%, of radiation poisoning die within the first 60 days after exposure. Those who live more than 5 months are still subject to a higher rate of cancer mortality than the general population. End footnote. The head of Hiroshima's rationing department is a man named Shinzo Hamai, who will one day become mayor himself. Before the bombing, concerned that the people of Hiroshima would not have food in the event of a major disaster, Hamai arranged that rice balls should be delivered to the city. So it is that villagers in the surrounding countryside make rice balls and deliver them to the hungry survivors in Hiroshima. Within days, the exodus from Hiroshima is complete. More than 150,000 residents travel by military truck or train to temporary shelters. The island of Ninoshima, 5 miles offshore in Hiroshima Bay and untouched by the A-bomb blast, is a storehouse for medical supplies and becomes the region's biggest relief center, providing comfort to more than 10,000 burn victims. The number of wounded quickly overwhelms the available hospital beds, leading many of the burned and maimed to sleep in stables and other enclosures. Bacterial infection stemming from the extreme smoke and debris of the blast runs rampant. Teams of doctors perform surgery around the clock, seeing so many patients that there is no time to clean the operating theater between victims. The most common procedure is amputation. The island facility is not actually a hospital, but a quarantine center that once housed military men and horses returning from duty in foreign lands. There is no provision for the removal of medical waste, so surgeons dispose of severed limbs by throwing them out hospital windows. Piles of arms and legs soon rise higher than the level of the window itself. Yet the amputees are the lucky ones. At least they are alive and can begin planning for a new future. Many victims of the blast who come to Ninoshima seeking medical help die within days from their infections and burns. At first, their corpses are stacked one on top the other for burning. But soon the number of dead bodies is so great that mass cremation becomes impossible. Instead, the dead are carried to air raid shelters and caves, where they are left to rot. These impromptu burial sites will be excavated decades later, uncovering not just bone fragments and ashes, but artifacts like rings and shoes that will help reveal the identities of the dead. This is the new reality in Hiroshima as Emperor Hirohito walks his gardens. Despite the unprecedented carnage, the God-man continues to dither.